This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Somewhere deep in the Treasury building, which sits right next to the White House, there is somebody whose job it's been for the past 3 months to say, yep, we're paying this bill. Nope, we're not paying this one, to keep the government from bumping past the debt limit. Extraordinary measures is what those pay-don't-pay decisions are called. And I should take a second here to remind you that this is money that's already been spent by Congress of both parties. And for another reminder, it's Republican senators who have refused persistently to raise the debt ceiling. The latest deadline to pull this $23 trillion economy back from the brink of default is December the 3rd.
Yeah, it's a recurring episode that has both political and economic consequences.
Carola Friedman studies financial history at Northwestern University.
Congress has revamped the limit since World War II 100 times.
Kathleen Day lectures at Johns Hopkins.
Sometimes it's suspended, sometimes it's raised.
And Eric Hilt is a professor at Wellesley.
But the reality is, as long as we're continuing to finance a lot of our budgets with deficit spending, Congress needs to revisit the issue from time to time.
So it's not a new thing.
The not new part of this debt ceiling thing is why we've gotten these three on the phone again. They're the economic historians we've been talking to since the early days of the pandemic for context on stuff happening now. Our lesson today, the debt limit, the origin story.
The debt ceiling is a vestige of the time when Congress was much more heavily involved in federal borrowing.
Like how?
Basically, every time that the Treasury needed money, they would get authorized a certain amount for whatever it is that they needed.
They would write legislation for specific bond issues.
A nice example is the construction of the Panama Canal.
A little job connecting the Atlantic and Pacific.
So here's how it worked. In 1902, Congress authorized the Treasury to issue Panama Canal bonds. The money from those bonds could only be used for that one project. Other projects, whatever the government wanted to do, were funded with their own bonds or their own taxes, and Treasury had to keep all those little piles of money separate.
That works when the economy and the projects are relatively simple and they're small.
Then when the U.S. entered World War One,
April 6, 1917.
That is a type of conflict where the financial needs are, first of all, unprecedented and also highly uncertain.
The American forces capture the base of the largest artillery weapon developed during the war.
And so this idea that you could go and specify how much you needed to borrow and you would be authorized for a particular type of security, a certain amount, it just doesn't work.
And so
Congress passed a law granting the Treasury the authority to issue war bonds up to some fixed amount. I think it was $5 billion at the time.
And presto, the first debt ceiling.
Eventually, that evolved into the debt limit that we have now, which is a single overall limit for all federal debt.
And the whole idea is to give the government more, or the Treasury, more flexibility.
That flexibility thing is key here. How much debt the Treasury Department feels it needs to sell to fund government projects, what denomination bonds and bills, and at what maturities. It's Janet Yellen's job to figure that out. And like Kathleen Day said earlier, the cap on how much Treasury can borrow to pay for everything that, again, Congress has already spent has been changed almost 100 times since World War II. It's now up to nearly $29 trillion.
To have that in the back of your mind, I do think, gives people pause about how they're spending money. But it hasn't always been done with all the acrimony and political football-ness that we now have.
Remember what's at stake here.
And, you know, it goes back to Alexander Hamilton. His first argument, the reason Alexander Hamilton is so famous is he's the person who said to George Washington and convinced the new American government, you can't default on your debt.
In fact, it's right there in the Constitution, Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, which says in relevant part, the validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned. That's a quote. And the present day reality is that the global market for U.S. debt is the biggest and most liquid debt market in the world, precisely because we pay what we owe. And we should be clear here. This is not an economic problem. It's politics all the way down.
Making our interest payments, making our required payments associated with our debt is perfectly feasible.
But at the end of the day, it doesn't make for very good policy, for this gamesmanship and this let's get to the brink to see who will blinkmanship.
We get in this political tug of war until there is some kind of relaxation. And that's been a very complicated, often painful process. So something that was supposed to make things more flexible has become quite binding and constraining.
And political. Thanks once again to our panelists, Eric Hilt at Wellesley, Carola Friedman at Northwestern, and Kathleen Day at Johns Hopkins. If you have a question for us, by the way, send it to us. Marketplace.org is where you can do that.